From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, two doctors examine the human body. Ira Rutko is a surgeon who's written a history of surgery. He'll tell us what operations were like before the days of anesthesia or antibiotics. Also, what happens to our bodies after we die? Dr. Kenneth Iserson's book, Death to Dust, details the decay. He hopes once people understand that death is a mutilating process, they won't be so worried about donating an organ or two to save someone's life. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Boys on the Side with Whoopi Goldberg, Mary Louise Parker, and Drew Barrymore. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says he wants a 90-cent increase in the minimum wage. This would bring the minimum wage to $5.15. The president wants to phase the increase in over 2 years, 45 cents a year. The idea faces very strong Republican opposition. Mr. Clinton held the announcement ceremony in the Rose Garden. No Republican lawmaker attended it today. The president says raising the minimum wage is the only way to reduce the underclass and make work pay. The government says unemployment went up last month. The Labor Department says the jobless rate rose 0.3% to 5.7%. The news surprised economists. Many had predicted it would hold steady. The government says for all of last year, 3.5 million jobs were created. That's the biggest job creation rate since 1988. The White House says the president's nominee to be Surgeon General has performed a small number of abortions. UPI's Bill Small has this report.
The question arose the day Dr. Henry Foster's nomination was announced, whether as a practicing gynecologist, Foster had ever performed abortions. It took Press Secretary Mike McCurry a day to come up with the answer.
In almost three decades as a private practicing physician, Dr. Foster believes that he performed most likely fewer than a dozen pregnancy terminations in hospital settings, none in outpatient settings.
McCurry says most of those were cases of rape or incest or where the life of the mother was in danger. And he took pains to point out the more than 10,000 babies that Foster delivered during the same period. Bill Small at the White House.
House Democrats David Obey of Wisconsin and Richard Durbin of Illinois are introducing a bill that would end federal responsibility for financing disaster relief. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Under the proposal, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, would be replaced by a federally chartered corporation that would function as an insurance company for states. How much a state would have to pay for disaster insurance would depend on how many disaster claims it's made over the past 10 years. Representative David Obey says the proposal reflects the federal government's new budget realities.
The balanced budget amendment to the Constitution has passed the House. I think that is going to require all of us to find many additional ways to save taxpayers' dollars. And I think this is certainly one of the first that is going to have to go on the block.
Obey says it's time for the federal government to stop picking up the tab for local governments that make poor zoning decisions and individuals who want to live in areas that are prone to floods and earthquakes. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
The stock market has had a busy day after learning the news of the increase in last month's unemployment rate. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 57 points at 3,928. The NASDAQ is up 8 points at 771. This is NPR. The president of Mexico says he will continue plans to privatize some major Mexican industries. Ernesto Zedillo says he'll appoint a commission to find ways to increase competition in telecommunications, ports, and highway construction. U.S. analysts say they believe the opening of Mexican markets is a prerequisite for getting $20 billion in U.S. financial support. Some Wall Street analysts say privatization will lure foreign investment to Mexico. For example, AT&T, Sprint, MCI, and Motorola all say they'll bid for Mexico's long-distance phone businesses when the national phone company loses its monopoly rights in 2 years. The controversial head of the World Health Organization is defending himself against reports he'd made a racial slur against Africans. Cindy Shiner reports from Geneva.
Dr. Hiroshi Nakajima called a press conference to clear his name after a local newspaper reported that he allegedly said Africans in the organization lacked writing and organizational skills. The staff committee wrote a letter to WHO officials saying African colleagues were offended by the remarks. Nakajima and other WHO officials, however, said his statement was taken out of context. He speaks poor English, and officials acknowledge that communication in the organization as a whole needs improvement. Nakajima said he didn't single out Africans, but said there was a general decline in writing ability among staff, particularly the young, especially those from Europe, the United States, and Africa. WHO officials said they were reluctant to release a transcript of the controversial meeting because it was private. In the past, Nakajima has been accused of being anti-feminist and anti-Scandinavian. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Geneva.
A judge has tentatively approved a settlement involving a nationwide salmonella outbreak. Thousands of people say they got ill after eating Schwan's ice cream last fall. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed at least 645 cases in 28 states. Officials believe the ice cream was contaminated by mix carried in trucks that had also carried raw eggs. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of us would be dead by now if it weren't for life-saving surgical techniques. But it wasn't too long ago that surgery was as likely to kill you as save you. Imagine how dangerous surgery could be in the days before antiseptic techniques, and how painful surgery must have been before anesthesia. Ira Rutko is a surgeon who's written several books on the history of surgery in the United States. His latest book is even more comprehensive. Surgery, an Illustrated History, begins in ancient Mesopotamia and ends in the 20th century. Before we hear the interview I recorded with him last year, you should know that some of his surgical descriptions are graphic and may disturb you. One of the things I was interested in was the phenomenon of barber surgeons. About 1,500 years ago, barbers were fixtures in monasteries where they trimmed the beards of the clerics who, in addition to their religious duties, performed primitive surgery.
By around the 10th century, the Roman Catholic Church made a decision that the clerics should not be involved in health care at all. Prior to that time, the clerics, because they were the most educated people within the continent, were involved in giving health care and, in fact, performed operations. So the only people who were then able to perform surgery were the barber/surgeons. And that is how barber surgeons came about. We're not talking about anesthesia. We're not talking about antisepsis. We're talking about people who really were performing functions which today for you and I would be removing a splinter or perhaps having, if you have a boil, incising it. That was what surgery was back then.
Well, why were the barbers trained in surgery?
It wasn't so much that they were trained in surgery. It was that they were there at the time, sort of like a lucky break. They were the only ones who saw the clerics performing surgery in the prior centuries. So naturally, it grew up with them and their families that they learned how to, and they actually took over the profession of surgery. If it weren't for the barber surgeons, surgery would not exist today as we know it.
Well, how far did barbers progress in the field of surgery?
In different countries at different times, they progressed right along the mainstream of surgery. And in fact, in certain countries, they actually became the surgeons that we would regard today as the modern forerunners of 1994 surgery. It really depends on what particular country you're dealing with. In England, for instance, the barber surgeons were very powerful. And eventually, they assumed control of the Royal College of Surgeons throughout the 16th and 17th, and well into the 18th century, the barber surgeons were very strong. And what happened eventually, in about 1750, the Royal College of Surgeons, which was actually called the Royal College of Barber Surgeons, split. They decided that the barbers were no longer integral to surgery, and the barbers were sort of shunted aside, and a new class of individuals arose, and they were the surgeons.
So was there a time you could go to the barbershop and get a shave, a haircut, and an amputation?
Oh, you ask an interesting question. In a men's barbershop, especially when I was a youngster, there was always a barber pole outside,
mm-hmm.
and it had a red and white thing that used to be circling around, electric motor.
The barber pole.
The barber pole. Well, the barber pole was a throwback to the barber surgeons, and they used to hang a towel outside their shop that was red to represent blood and white to represent cleanliness. And that was how the barber pole started.
What was it like to perform surgery in the days before anesthesia? Anesthesia was first invented in the mid-1800s, but there were plenty of surgical operations performed before that. How complicated were those operations? And maybe you could give us a sense of what it was like to do it without anesthesia.
It was not a very pleasant experience. And one of the most graphic discussions of the entire pre-anesthetic surgical literature involves a mastectomy that was done on a member of the royal family. Actually, she was a noblewoman in England in about 1820. And it's quite graphic. She explains how the surgeon removed her breast with a knife without any anesthesia, how they were screaming and the pain that was involved. It was not a pleasant sight. It's very funny, though, when you look at pictures of surgery prior to 1840 where things are depicted, it's very uncommon to see the patient struggling and screaming. Yet, I can't imagine as an individual in 1994 having somebody amputate my leg or my arm, let alone a breast, and not squirming and screaming and moving around. Yet all the pictures depict very placid patients who are calm. It's something that I've never been able to understand as a historian of surgery.
Do you think they were drugged?
They attempted to drug people. They had opium derivatives and other things. I mean, opium was something which had been around for many years. Obviously, they were not narcotics. They did not have cocaine and morphine and things like that. But there were attempts to give people, let's say, liquor. Alcohol was used, but it wasn't really all that effective. It's hard to imagine that if you're drunk and you're going to have your leg amputated, that you're not going to feel pain.
Maybe they passed out.
Often they did pass out. If you read the descriptions of surgery from the Renaissance on up through around 1850, they talk about having four or five holders, people who would have to hold the patient down. But you must understand, surgery was something that was a last resort. It was not therapy as we think of it today, where if you have, let's say, a gallbladder that's bad, that it has to be removed. You have little choice. If you have appendicitis, it has to be taken care of. Otherwise, you will die from it. Back then, very often, the therapy was worse than the disease. Getting operated on was not a lot of fun.
Well, you point out in your book that in the days before anesthesia, a surgeon was prized if he could work very quickly.
Yes, yes. Well, like we said, if you're going to have your leg amputated and you don't have anesthesia and you are the patient, I think that you want to go to the surgeon who moves the fastest. It behooves you, in fact, to go to the surgeon who moves the fastest. So that very often, the surgeon would walk in, and it was, I mean, common knowledge. The surgeons were very stern figures, and they would wear their coats. Tell you that they used to wear the same coat from one operation to the next. You know how nowadays we wear different gowns and we throw them away or they get re-sterilized or whatever? Back then, they would wear a black coat, almost looks like a tuxedo coat, a formal dress coat, and they would walk into the operating room. They would do the amputation, wipe the bloody knife on their coat so they would remove the blood, put the knife onto the table where it would lay for the next case, whether that was the next day or the next month, and the coat they would hang up and would have all your blood on it, and then a month later when they would do the next operation, they would put the coat back on, and that's how they went about doing things. But regarding the speed of the operation, it behooved the surgeon to operate fast. They had to. They had no choice. So that a surgeon would very often tell the audience, time me. Watch how fast I can do the amputation. And there are many records that were set. It's amazing how nowadays we think of surgery as something which is very precise and very orderly and something which is done very diligently. Back then, and I'm talking again in the 17th and 18th centuries, they literally would do an amputation in 40 seconds.
Wow.
Yes.
This is before power tools.
we're talking about one entire sweep of a knife down to the bone.
Wow.
I don't want to sound gruesome here. But they would go down to the bone with one sweep around your entire leg or arm, and they would take a saw and cut off the bone, and the amputation was done.
Gee, you know, I'm thinking how really bloody surgery must have been in the 17th and 18th century before there were clamps for blood vessels.
It was very bloody, and clamps were something which really did not come about until the mid to late 19th century. When surgeons such as William Halsted in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins and Theodore Coker in Bern, Switzerland started using them, they would do operations where you literally have pictures of maybe 100 to 150 clamps at a time in the operative field that they would then clamp blood vessels with and have to tie off to stop the bleeding. What happened prior to that, though, was they used to take a mass ligature. They would take something sort of like a piece of silk, a string, and they would just tie everything all at once. They would include the blood vessel in the arm, the nerve in the arm, the vein in the arm, and just tie everything. and what would happen over the course of time, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, after infection set in. You must realize that infection was something which was considered part of being operated on. It was called laudatory pus. And that laudatory pus was something that they wanted to happen. They wanted you to get infected. Of course, they didn't realize it was getting infected. In retrospect, we realized it was getting infected. They wanted that to occur.
Laudatory is a praise word.
Yes.
Why did they think the appearance of pus was good?
Because they didn't understand that it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is historical perspective. You must understand history. And we're talking again about something which happened 300 years ago. So they thought that it was natural for this exuberant or laudatory pus to happen. We're literally... buckets and buckets of pus would fall off of somebody's wound.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Ira Rutko. He's a surgeon and author of the new book, Surgery and Illustrated History. Most of the period that you write about covers the years before doctors knew anything about microbiology, before they understood infection and how it could be prevented during surgery.
Yes.
So did most wounds get terribly infected? This was typical?
It was not unusual that the patients died from operations. For instance, let's take the Civil War. The Civil War was one of the major calamities in the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And yet from this major calamity, there was much which came out of good, and meaning particular surgery. There were literally thousands, tens of thousands of amputations that were done on a daily to monthly to yearly basis. I have a picture from a battle, I think it's Antietam, where there's a picture of severed limbs, both arms and legs, literally a pile of 20 of them, and it says, a day in the life of a surgeon in the field. When you got shot in the limb, or if you even broke your extremity, back prior to the time of Lister in 1870 and antisepsis, the common treatment was to do an amputation. It was expected that if you were shot in the, let's say, the upper arm, that you were going to have your arm amputated.
To prevent terrible infection?
To prevent infection from setting in, because that you would get gangrene and you would die. Now, the problem was that in doing the amputation, which again they would do in maybe a minute and it would be done, they would take a hot burning iron and put it to the end of the amputation site to sear the blood vessels to stop the bleeding. Of course, that would cause infection. So as a consequence, and no one really knows the percentages, but the wounds themselves, the amputation sites, ended up being infected. And I would say that you're looking at an infection rate of maybe 75% to 80%. Maybe 1 in 5 people did not have an infection from their operation.
Were a lot of surgical procedures performed under pretty dirty conditions because doctors didn't understand that dirt would lead to infection?
It depends what you mean by dirty conditions. Compared to what we know today, obviously it was very dirty. Compared to what they thought at the time, they thought they were being clean. Their idea of cleanliness was, again, walking into the room, taking the knife, which was bloody from the prior operation, dipping it into water to get off the old blood stain, and then going ahead and doing the operation. Because they just had no knowledge at all in terms of infection, in terms of antisepsis. It was something which didn't occur to them. So if something doesn't occur to you, it's very difficult for you to imagine at that time, in 1850, that it's dirty. Dirty didn't exist to them.
How was it discovered that microorganisms breed infection and that there was a way to prevent infection?
The entire concept of microorganisms and infection was not something that happened overnight. There was a gradual evolution, and this evolutionary process really took many centuries. But it all culminated in around the 1840s and 1850s in Germany and in France, by individuals with the name of Pasteur and Claude Bernard and Virchow and other well-known people within the fields of medicine. It was never initially surgeons who found out that organisms were causing infections. That was something that Pasteur and other individuals, Robert Koch, that they did. What happened was that in England, Joseph Lister took up the concept of microorganisms causing infection, and he finally put one and one together and got two. And that's how, in the 1870s, we began to realize that antisepsis and cleanliness were the most important things that a surgeon would need to prevent infection.
My guest is Dr. Ira Rutko. He's a surgeon and a historian of surgery. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Ira Rutko, author of the new book Surgery, An Illustrated History. You have an illustration of a cesarean section.
Yes.
That's performed, and I forget what the year is, but it's centuries ago.
It's in the 16th century.
I was really surprised that C-sections were able to be performed that long ago.
Well, C-sections were performed, of course, back to ancient Roman times. There are some people who say the reason they're called cesarean sections is that Julius Caesar was born that way.
Huh.
Now, whether that's apocryphal or not, no one really knows. But C-sections have been around literally for 2,000 years, and they were not done with the sophistication that we have today. And very often the mother died from the actual operation to save the child. But C-sections are not something which are new. They've been around for many times. There are certain operations, and we can go through them. C-section is one, the removal of stones from the bladder, hernias, another operation on the brain called trephination, where they drill a hole through the skull and attempt to remove blood clots, or back then, if people thought that there were a disease within your brain, they would drill a hole through your skull and let the bad vapors evaporate. Those were the most common operations that were done back then. In those operations, hernias, the trephination on the brain, C-sections, and lithotomy, removal of bladder stones, have followed up through the last 2,000 years. And you can see the sophistication of these as they grow.
In earlier days of surgery, were surgeons respected?
Respected, of course, is a relative term, but certainly if we think of surgeons and doctors as they are in America in 1994, the answer is absolutely no. The respect for surgery did not occur, at least in this country, until the 1880s and 1890s. That's really when surgeons came about. It's very interesting if you read some of the literature from the mid to three-quarters way of the 19th century in the United States, there was really not a group of individuals known as surgeons. Back then, everybody was a physician slash surgeon.
Mm-hmm. You write about how in medieval times, a medieval surgeon stood in jeopardy of losing his life if he operated unsuccessfully on a feudal lord. And there was an edict that stipulated that the surgeon whose patient died should be handed over
to the family
of the patient so that the family
Absolutely.
Could do what they wished with the surgeon.
Absolutely. And the wise surgeon back then did not operate that often. I mean, he only operated when they knew that they were going to get the patient better. It's not uncommon that there were stories where surgeons were killed operating on somebody because of a death resultant from that operation. And it's not only that the surgeon might have died. If they operate on, let's say, a patient for a cataract or for a problem with the eye, and the operation was not a success, well, what happened was that the surgeon would have his eye removed. And it sounds a little gruesome, but that's what used to go on. And that's really why a branch of surgery called itinerant surgeons came about. Itinerant surgeons were individuals. They were not in the class of barber surgeons. They were another group of surgeons. They would go from town to town. That's why they were called itinerant. They would perform an operation, and it's said that prior to the bad results actually occurring, the itinerant surgeon was gone
right.
from the town so that they couldn't do anything to him.
Huh.
And that's how
before the days of malpractice, it sounds a lot worse.
Oh. I'm not sure what's worse, getting hit for malpractice suit of $1 million or losing your arm. They're both very difficult situations.
What was it like the first time you observed an operation?
Well, I will confess that the first time I saw an operation, I fainted. And I was about 15 years old. I had a cousin who was an ear, nose, throat surgeon in New York City. He took me into the operating room. He was going to do a rhinoplasty. Somebody's going to have their nose fixed. And I remember very distinctly to perform that operation, they had to break the bone in the nose to remodel it. And the last thing I remember was the room getting sort of circling around me, and I wasn't able to hear much, and I was on the floor. It was embarrassing as a 15-year-old who wanted to become a surgeon.
Well, how come you stuck with it after having such a bad reaction?
Well, I always enjoyed surgery. I think surgery, there are personality types that go into particular fields in medicine, and surgery tends to look for a definitive answer. I consider myself to be an obsessive compulsive personality. That's why I write. And surgery provides an immediate answer to a particular situation. It's different than treating somebody with diabetes or emphysema, where the treatment literally goes on for years into decades. Surgery, you have an answer. You go in, You open up a person, you remove the disease, and the patient gets better, hopefully.
Now, what about the first time you performed the operation?
First time I performed the operation, well, it was 1975. I was an intern, and the attending surgeon, this was up in Boston, said to me, well, I think that you're going to do the hernia today. And I looked at this gentleman, and I said, what? And I remember very distinctly, he said, well, you better go read about it, because you've done enough of them that you've assisted now, and I would like you to start. And it's a nerve-wracking experience. The first time you take a scalpel in your hand and realize that you're going to have to cut into another person's body to relieve them of a misery that they have. It is something which you have to learn to do. It is the rare individual that it comes easily to.
Do you have a very steady hand?
I have a steady hand, yes. But it's not something that I would tell you that happened overnight. I've always had steady hands. But I've never seen an individual yet. It's very interesting. Whenever you operate with somebody who's new, or if you have a new nurse in the operating room, whenever they touch an instrument, they start shaking at the beginning. It's very scary to cut on another individual.
Oh, I'll bet it is. I don't doubt that at all. Do you ever get over that?
Do you ever get over it? I think that surgery is something that you never get over, the mystery of it. I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to take care of another human being and make them better. And I think that you have to approach it that way each day and not lose sight of the fact that you're operating on somebody who is another human being and that you want to get them better. But do I ever lose that? No. I think it's something, and I don't think that a surgeon should lose it. I think you have to be cognizant of what you're doing on a daily basis. If it becomes rote and the person doesn't mean anything as a human being, then you might be in the wrong field.
Have you ever had surgery?
Yes. Yes, I had my appendix out when I was 19 years old.
But you haven't had surgery since becoming a surgeon?
No, I've never had surgery since I became a surgeon. And I would be lying to you to tell you that I would not be scared. I would be scared of getting operated on. I think that it's natural. I think that any person that I see in the office who tells me that they're not concerned and not scared, I think that they're lying to me. I think it's natural to be scared. Surgery is one of the greatest things that we as a race, as human beings, have been able to do, that we can cut into another person, relieve that misery, the mystery that's inside there, make that person better. It's essential to the flowering of all of human existence.
One last question for you. Do you ever play music in the operating room?
No, it's funny that you say that, because I go into operating... When I was in residency, I used to go into operating rooms where surgeons would always have music on. And when I write, when I operate, when I do anything, I have to have silence. Not that I mind talking, but I don't like having music on, particularly when I operate and when I write. I never have music, and I love classical music, but I don't listen.
But a lot of surgeons do.
Oh, absolutely. I go into operating rooms where other surgeons are on, and there's rock and roll blasting and whatever.
Is that disrespectful, or is that okay?
I don't think it's disrespectful. I think that if it makes the surgeon feel at ease within the milieu of their particular operating room, then I think it's exactly what you want. You want your surgeon to feel most comfortable with what they're doing on your body.
Dr. Rutko, thank you very much. It's been fascinating.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Dr. Ira Rutko is the author of Surgery, An Illustrated History. Our interview was recorded last March. I'm Cheri Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Cheri Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition, what happens to the body after death? Dr. Kenneth Iserson answers this question in his book, Death to Dust. He wrote it to encourage more people to donate their organs after death. Many people don't donate organs because they fear it will mutilate their body. Dr. Isaacson says this really shouldn't matter. Death itself is a mutilating process. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Boys on the Side with Whoopi Goldberg, Mary Louise Parker, and Drew Barrymore. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has proposed raising the minimum wage by 90 cents to $5.15 an hour. He made the announcement this morning in a White House Rose Garden ceremony. The president argues the only way to increase the middle class and shrink the underclass is to make work pay.
I hope more than anything that we will have a genuine, bipartisan, well-founded welfare reform legislation this year that will encourage work and responsible parenting and independence. But we cannot hope to have it succeed unless the people we are asking to work can be rewarded for their labors.
Under the president's plan, the minimum wage would rise 45 cents in each of the next 2 years. But he's going against solid Republican opposition in Congress. Not a single GOP legislator attended today's ceremony. The Associated Press is quoting administration officials who say Mr. Clinton will suggest abolishing or consolidating hundreds of programs to save $144 billion. The savings would come over 5 years. Mr. Clinton's budget is to be released Monday. It's reportedly estimated at more than $1.5 trillion. The budget projects a deficit of a little less than $200 billion for the 1996 fiscal year. Republicans and some Democrats are attacking the president's budget. They say it doesn't have enough cuts to reach a balanced budget by the year 2002. The government has released two economic reports. First, the Labor Department says unemployment rose in January by 0.3%. The jobless rate stands now at 5.7%. The Commerce Department says factory orders rose 1.7% in December. It helps drive up orders for all of last year to 10.2%. The French government has called for an international conference on Algeria, which is embroiled in a civil war between Islamic radicals and the military regime in Algiers. As many as 30,000 people have died in the fighting. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
President François Mitterrand called for the conference at a meeting with the new members of the European Commission. France is currently chairing the rotating presidency of the European Union. The president would like the EU at the summit, but he wants other countries there as well. Mitterrand told reporters the EU is not alone in being able to put Algeria back on track. Presidential aide said the conference would be based on the recent summit in Rome of Algerian opposition parties. That meeting ended with a call for an end to the civil war, a demand for the release of 10,000 jailed Islamic activists, and the legalization of the Islamic Salvation Front, the FIS. The Algerian government and a radical Islamic group have rejected the proposed truce. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow gained nearly 58 points to end at 3,928. Trading was very heavy. This is NPR. 10 black men are suing a Georgia town after being banned from several stores. Names of some of the men are on a list of potential shoplifters that was passed out by police in the town of Union Point. The men's attorney says at least 8 men have not been charged with theft or shoplifting. He's filed a federal lawsuit against the town, the mayor, and 16 businesses. Police Chief Richard Reese says he checked with lawyers who say the list is legal, and he says they've not had any problems with, quote, white shoplifters. The town's only 2 black businesses supported the ban, but one later lifted it. Alaska's Governor Tony Knoll says he'll support a controversial plan by the Forest Service to create new wildlife conservation zones in the Tongass National Forest. The zone would put areas of old-growth forests off-limits to logging. Paula Dobbin of member station KTOO reports from Juneau.
Knowles canceled the wolf control program after the Department of Public Safety released a report which found that fish and game officials mismanaged the effort and caused the indiscriminate killing of other wildlife besides wolves.
The report concluded that the program was poorly run, that it's an unacceptable way that any state program be carried out this way. It was an inhumane way to treat any animal.
The report found that although the snares are designed to kill wolves instantly, 34% of wolves were found alive, some with their legs chewed off, and that many other animals, including moose and caribou, were also found trapped. The wolf control effort was aimed at reversing the decline of the Delta caribou, but its scientific value has never been proved. For National Public Radio, I'm Paula Dobbin in Juneau.
Chechen fighters are digging in. They've fortified a strategic town on the western border. They are anticipating a strong Russian attack. Russian troops have shelled the town, but rebels say they are expecting a much heavier attack. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about a subject some people consider unspeakable. What happens to a body after death? My guest has a good reason for talking about it. He thinks if people understand this, they'll be more likely to donate their organs after death. Before we hear our interview, which was recorded last spring, I should advise you that some listeners might be disturbed by the descriptions of the body after death. Dr. Kenneth Iserson directs the Arizona Bioethics Program at the University of Arizona, where he's also a professor of surgery. He practices emergency medicine and is the medical director of Southern Arizona's major search and rescue operation. In his book, Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies, he says that approximately 25 different organs and types of tissues can be used for transplant now, and the list is growing. Yet, Americans aren't donating. He wants you to know that your corpse is going to end up looking pretty bad no matter what, so you might as well consider donating your organs when you go.
Death is a mutilating experience no matter what you do. So be generous and help the living.
What are some of the fears people have about donating their organs?
There's a number of fears, Terry, and they're culturally based. One of the great fears is that they're going to become organ and tissue donors before they really had to die. That's actually obviated in our society because the rules are is that a different medical team has to be taking care of you than the team that decides on, for example, death by brain criteria, brain death, or the team that takes your organs. That's a major fear. Others, which are about how the body is going to be treated after death, are that embalming won't be possible or an open casket funeral won't be possible if you donate your organs and tissues.
Is that true?
Not true at all. Not true at all. In fact, modern morticians are specifically trained in how to restore bodies, make them presentable, if nearly every organ and tissue that's possible to take has been taken. And they can still have the open casket funeral. And as we say, only your mortician knows for sure.
Do you find a lot of people are afraid of the pain, even though rationally they know they'd be dead by the time the organs were removed?
That doesn't seem to be a big determinant. It's more the question that, boy, the body's going to be mutilated. They've suffered enough. But in fact, the people that are suffering are the ones that need the organs and tissues to continue a full life or to have a full life. And no matter what you do, being dead is a mutilating experience.
Well, I want to warn our listeners that some people will be absolutely fascinated by these details, and other people will be very uncomfortable hearing them. So, listeners, be advised. I want to talk with you first about the viewing of bodies. You know, when you see a body laid out in a funeral home, it gives you the idea that you can actually be quite attractive in death, nicely dressed and made up, and people can leave the funeral saying, he looked good.
He looked good.
you give a lot of fascinating details about how this illusion of looking good is created. Let's start with how a mortician can get rid of the pain or suffering on a dead person's face.
Well, the whole industry calls it making a beautiful memory picture, which is what you've just described. They actually massage the muscles and the facial structures to allow some of the muscles to relax and to ease some of the contractures that have gone on in the facial muscles. And some of these are just postmortem changes, and some of them may have been looking like the person was in agony. But it's all smoke and mirrors, as they say. It doesn't do anything to help the person, of course. They're dead.
If rigor mortis has set in and the body has stiffened, how does the mortician move the body around? For instance, get the arms crossed across the chest?
Oh, well, sometimes, actually, it's almost impossible to do it depending on the state of when they get the body. But indeed, rigor mortis comes on at various times at various speeds and then wears off. So the body eventually does become loose. So again, it depends when the mortician actually gets the body. But they can oftentimes massage the muscles and get them into a certain position. Once they have embalmed the body, however, it often takes on fairly rigid type of position, at least for a while. And so they have to be careful about how they position the body.
Mm-hmm. One thing that really amazed me, some body parts are kept in their positions with the help of super glue or rubber cement.
Super glue has long been used by embalmers to keep eyes closed, keep mouths closed, to do other kind of things, sealing certain holes in the body. So kind of magic.
If eyes are closed after death, will they open if they're not glued shut?
They can be partially open if they're not glued shut. They're always kept shut one way or another. There's something called an eye cap also that can be used with or without the super glue, and it's put under the eyelids, and it has little ridges on it, and it holds the tissue closed from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's one reason why eyes are donated so frequently, even oftentimes without family's knowledge. In some states, that's permissible, because truly there's no way of anyone else telling other than the mortician whether the eyes have been donated, because you're going to be putting something in to replace any eyes that are taken out. The eyes are going to always be closed.
My guest is Dr. Kenneth Iserzin, head of the bioethics program at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the new book, Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Kenneth Iserzin, author of the new book, Death to Dust. You are, among other things, an emergency room physician. And as we said before, one of the reasons why you wrote this book is that you'd like people to think more seriously about donating their organs when they die and to be assured that their body will be mutilated whether they donate their organs or not, because, as you say, death is a mutilating experience. Are you often in the position of trying to talk to family members as somebody is dying or has just died, trying to convince the family to have that person's organs donated? That's such a sensitive subject. And what an awful time to have to talk to a family about that.
You're absolutely right. I've talked to people over my career as an emergency physician, both about donating their loved ones' organs and tissues, and also the question of autopsy when they weren't automatically a medical examiner's case. It's a terrible time to be talking to people, and in this case, people who I've never met before, because as an emergency physician, I've never met this patient. I've never met this family, you know, unlike the general practitioner or the surgeon or others who may have known these folks ahead of time. But there is a limited amount of time that's available in which to donate organs and tissues. And so we have to ask. We have to ask early on. It helps. In many, many states now, they have a checkoff on the back of the driver's license. We often have driver's licenses for these people, and it says, yes, I would like to donate my organs and tissues. And we show that, and we ask the family whether they will go along with this person's wishes.
How do you bring it up to the family?
Well, In fact, in my situation, I have a double trouble role as it is. I first have to tell them that he has died or she has died. After that, with the same team, usually nurses, their own family support group, our chaplain, we've used our morticians who are specially trained in the past, I go ahead and would ask them, prefacing it, I guess, first with the fact that it's an awful time to be asking this, but we don't have any choice because there's a limit on time. If they want to give the gift of organs and tissues from their loved one to help others. In fact, many families are very thankful that they get asked because they want to do it, but they're not willing to bring up the subject. They may not even have thought about the subject right at that point in time, but they are glad that someone is asking. And in fact, we know from large studies, as well as personal experience, is that afterwards they feel good about that, especially, I mean, we're a major trauma center, and we see a lot of young people who tragically die. This allows them to know that many people are often helped by the donations of organs and tissues from their loved one.
So I guess a lot of people find some, if not consolation, but find something in the idea that the person who they love so much who has died will, in their death, be at least helping to save someone else's life.
Sure, because if you think about it, we're not saying they're going to help one person, but if they donate both eyes, they're going to help two people see again, mm-hmm. perhaps people hear again with ears, the ear bones that can be transplanted, skin for burn victims. By the way, maybe we should say something just about the skin. I talk to people about skin donations and they go, ugh, skin, you know. But in fact, the layer of skin that they take is no more than a sunburn that peels off in a sunburn. So it's almost nothing. And it's usually in areas like in the back where they can't see it. But they can take bones, the pancreas, now, in some cases, the intestines, certainly hearts, lungs, livers, kidneys, you know, on and on. And the list is growing.
If you want to donate your organs when you die, what plans can you make in advance for it? What do you do?
Well, as I said, most states have checkoffs on the back of their driver's licenses. In fact, you can also get a separate organ and tissue donor card from your local organ procurement organization, oftentimes your hospitals, certainly the university medical centers, will have special people and they'll send you out the cards. You sign them and carry them with you. But the most important thing, absolutely, no matter what else you do, is you have to tell your loved ones that that's what you want. Because the standard of care in this country, virtually everywhere, is that if the physicians, the surgeons, are going to ask the family after you die whether they want to donate your organs and tissues. And if you've told them and explained to them why, your family, then they'll be more willing to do it. But even if you've signed, as they say, you can have a signed organ and tissue donor card in every pocket and one pasted to your forehead when you die. And if your family doesn't agree, you don't get to donate.
Are there things looking back now that you think you were naive about when you started your research for your book?
Oh, probably almost everything in there. The last book that was comprehensive about what happened to dead bodies was written 118 years ago in England. I didn't have a source to get most of this information, and I couldn't find the answers to almost anything. And that's the naivety is what drove me on to write the book, is I just listed all the questions that I had. I said, I've been dealing with corpses my entire career, and my career started before even medical school because I drove an ambulance for 5 years. So, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. And I said, I don't know all these answers. My colleagues don't know these answers. The lay public doesn't know these answers. You know, the chaplains don't, the lawyers don't. I mean, nobody knows. And the funeral industry doesn't know all these answers either, as has been proved out. So I said, let me start looking into this. And it just kind of developed and developed into the project that turned into the book.
Do you think that the research you did for your book changed your attitude about funerals or about what you want to happen to your body after death?
Yeah, it actually did. I was somewhat ambivalent about what happened to my body. But what I finally came to figure out is that it's really the person that's important, and I wanted kind of simplicity in what would happen to my body after death. So what I put in, and actually I put a little coda in the back of the book, because while I was writing, a lot of people were asking me, so I put a little paragraph in the back, said that when I died, just cremate the body and scatter the ashes up on what we call Finger Rock, which is part of our Catalina Mountains. I'm with search and rescue here and spend a lot of time up in those mountains. I thought that would just be kind of nice. But you know what? And of course, that's after every organ and tissue that can be used is donated.
Mm-hmm.
That's afterwards, right. But the whole book has helped me realize even more so, it's fun to be alive. Do everything you can while you're alive to, you know, make it fun.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Kenneth Iserson is the author of Dust to Dust. He directs the Arizona Bioethics Program at the University of Arizona. Our interview was recorded last spring. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. The president formally proposed raising the minimum wage today. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about the president's proposal to increase it by 45 cents a year over 2 years, a general increase of 90 cents. We'll also have a story on what it's like living on the minimum wage. It's now at $4.25. Reporter Ed Lifson in Chicago visited a household whose wages are at the minimum wage. Also in today's program, a pinball tournament in New York City. The Week in Congress in review with Elizabeth Arnold and Major Garrett. We'll also be hearing about Dutch folklore, about dikes and little boys who prevent floods, and a tuba quartet.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Herbert Ross has been a dancer, a choreographer, a Broadway musical director, and a director of 24 feature films, from hits like The Turning Point, Footloose, and The Goodbye Girl, to flops like Max Dugan Returns and his last film, Undercover Blues. His 25th film stars Whoopi Goldberg, Mary Louise Parker, and Drew Barrymore. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Boys on the Side.
Herbert Ross has made female buddy pictures before. Steel Magnolias was one of them, and so, in a way, was The Turning Point. But the contemporary female buddy picture came of age in 1991 with Thelma and Louise, and that put a new spin on the genre. Not only was it a road picture, but it let female buddies be what male buddies have so often been, outlaws on the lam. That little twist added sex appeal and suspense. Trouble is, Thelma and Louise did it so well that its imitators pale by comparison. Take Boys on the Side, a movie that would have paled without the comparison. Whoopi Goldberg plays Jane, a lesbian rock singer who wants to get out of New York and try to make it in L.A. She needs to share a ride to the coast, so she answers an ad placed by Robin, played by Mary Louise Parker. She's a prissy real estate agent whom Jane quickly comes to think of as the whitest human in America. Since these two have nothing in common, we know they're going to become the best of friends. When they hit Pittsburgh, they stop to visit Jane's pal, Holly, played by Drew Barrymore, and they find her in the midst of a pitched battle with her drug dealer boyfriend, Nick. Holly wallops Nick over the head with a baseball bat, then the three women tie him to a chair and leave him alive but not terribly well as they pile into Robin's car and head for the coast. But by the time they hit St. Louis, the newspapers there are announcing that back in Pittsburgh, Nick has died of his wounds. Presumably those St. Louis papers are more complete than the ones I'm used to. Jane thinks Holly should go back and turn herself in. Robin begs to differ.
Why does she have to go back? Why don't we just pretend we never saw it?
Please tell me you're kidding.
No. When we left, he was alive. How do we know that what she did killed him? Exactly. I mean, he could have tripped and hit his head on the bat. It could happen.
No. You're going back. This is not a game.
I can't go to jail, not with the baby. What baby, honey? I'm 8 weeks pregnant.
What? You were going to bring a baby into that house?
Oh, like what were my options?
How about abortion?
I couldn't do that. I'd feel like a murderer.
Honey, you are a murderer.
As you might imagine, they don't return to Pittsburgh. They hit the road again so we can watch them bond and bond and bond. When the movie reaches Tucson, it veers off the road. The three set up housekeeping there, and Holly falls in love with a handsome policeman who's even dumber than she is. As they spend many happy hours delighting each other with their lovable stupidity, we seem to be watching the first of what I'm afraid will be 100 cinematic sons and daughters of Forrest Gump. Meanwhile, tragedy strikes Jane and Robin, and the movie becomes a gigantic wheezing tearjerker, dripping lessons about tolerance and love for one's fellow woman. The three actresses are charming, especially, and most surprisingly, Drew Barrymore, who makes Holly convincingly dense without falling into the twin traps of turning her into either a wiggly bimbo or someone to feel sorry for. But acting can't save this film. It's at once terribly manipulative and terribly empty. If you're dying to hear a good movie inform you that sisterhood is powerful, with or without boys on the side, well, Little Women should still be playing at a theater near you.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers with Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Our program was directed today by Alan Tu and Roberta Sherrock. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Marita Golden about her new memoir, Saving Our Sons, Raising Black Children in a Turbulent World. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.